It's the California Wine Country Podcast with Steve Jackson and Dan Berger. We taste, we laugh, we learn.
Before we head into California Wine Country with Dan Berger, after the top of the hour break, we're going to talk to Rex Pickett and Dan Berger, and we have the winemaker from BV. I cannot pronounce Rex Ken. I cannot pronounce the name Beaulieu.
Beaulieu Vineyard.
Beaulieu.
Beaulieu.
Beaulieu translates into English as a beautiful place.
Beaulieu. No, I see. I can't do it.
Beaulieu.
One more glass, Steven.
Yeah, I'll be speaking French fluently. Yeah. So, okay, we were under the impression that you knew Dan Berger and vice versa, but it was apparently that wasn't the case. Somebody called you when you were working at the L.A. Times to talk about Pinot Noir because he was writing a book, and you assumed it was Dan. It was Rex.
I didn't remember the name. It's been 20-some years, and so all we did was talk for about an hour about Pinot Noir, and in particular about San Ynez and that whole Santa Barbara County area. So my assumption was that it was you, and I guess maybe it wasn't, so that's the way that is.
We want to talk about the book, the movie, and now it's been adapted by Rex as a play at Left Edge Theater in Santa Rosa at the LBC. But, Dan, your thoughts, and we've talked about this before, about the movie Sideways, that kind of made Merlot kind of not so likable.
Well, I think the Merlot situation was a consequence. I think the book was really more about Pinot Noir. I don't think it was about Merlot in any way. Merlot is an entire different discussion. I think what's most interesting is that Rex put his finger on the pulse of the industry at the time, that people were talking about it inside the industry, but nobody else was. And this was the growth of an explosion of great Pinot Noir throughout the United States, and in particular from cooler regions, Sonoma County and Santa Barbara County being the two leading proponents. And this was a monumental breakthrough in a certain way because it was a book really not about wine, more about personalities and people. And it was a very entertaining book and a great movie, but it really tapped into something that was much more wine-related than that. Rex Wood, you didn't anticipate the firestorm.
Of course not. I'm just writing a novel. I was going to wine tastings in Santa Monica, and I was just overwhelmed by, you know, how deep the world was in wine. I was drinking wine, but I really didn't know what I was drinking that much, and I love the lyricism and the poetry that surrounded it. Some of it is, of course, very pretentious. But you're absolutely right. I was just at that time when Miles says one line about Merlot. I mean, he doesn't go on and on about it. And he's really trying to stop the train wreck of his friend, remember, about to commit, you know, infidelity here. You know, I didn't know that, of course, it was going to be a movie. I didn't know that line, I didn't do the adaptation, was going to be in the movie. And it was going to be – it's the number one thing I have to write on books is no effing Merlot. It's the number first question I have or whatever. But we did tap into something. Merlot had been overcropped, and they were 20% of the red wine at that time sales. And they really earned the reputation. We really – I believe you wrote a great article recently that we – the movie thinned out the herd, and the good guys like Duckhorn and others, Schaefer, they've remained standing.
Yeah, the only
I did them a favor.
You bet you did.
And of course, Pinot Noir. I mean, I had a guy up at Arista Winery up at Ace. I should kiss you. I said, well, let's not get too excited. But it did a lot for Pinot Noir. And at that time, you're absolutely right, Dan. Inside the wine aficionados and connoisseurs or whatever, we were talking about Pinot. Well, we were moving away from Cab and Chardonnay.
Absolutely. You know, I was writing about it on a regular basis, and my editors wondered why I was doing this. And, of course, you had really put a much more commercial face on it, and it was really entertaining. I mean,
thank you.
Your characters are so flawed. It's just wonderful that flawed characters can pick up the greatness of Pinot. This is amazing.
And we're going through a rough patch.
Yeah, I would say.
You know, Dan, I think we've talked about this on this segment before, and Rex and I were discussing it out in the green room earlier today, but Merlot had gotten to a point, and he – well, you explain it.
Well, actually, Dan wrote the article. It's great. I want to just give it a quick synopsis. But in early 90s, 60 Minutes did a thing on the French paradox. You know, drink all the red wine you want, and you can eat fatty foods, and you'll live forever. So everybody rushed out to get red wine, and they were initially given Cabernet Sauvignon, which can be tannic and a little bit astringent to a neophyte palate. And so then they gravitated to the more approachable, more fruity Merlot. They suddenly – thus was born the vitamin E of the 90s.
In 1992, California had 8,000 acres of Merlot. In 1995, there were 58,000 acres of Merlot.
And they were mechanized farming it. And I mean,
and it wasn't that good.
It was terrible. It was planted in the wrong
places.
The clusters
were going down the conveyor belts with snakes and mice and leaves. and thus Miles is
tails out of school. If I
thus Miles' vilification of Merlot.
Absolutely.
When people ask me, I say they earned it.
And now that has, over all these years, come back around, right?
Yeah, there's some
and people
really
are
wonderful.
Really making good Merlots.
Oh, there's good
again.
Merlot all over the place now, but you have to be very careful. There's still some out of that 58, we're down to about 29,000 acres of Merlot, and still way too much, and planted in the wrong places
and
in some cases.
You have to be careful about that. I'm going to write a sequel.
Yeah.
I'm going to take you down again.
All right. I'm sure we have to take a break. Mike has been washing wine glasses, so... He's just getting back in the studio. 1 minute? Okay. My friend Jim from BV is here, and I just want to remind folks, and I know I talked about this when we were in Washington, D.C. a year ago. I believe it was the April trip, yeah. Jim was there along with our friend...
Jim Morris.
Jim Morris, thank you. And we were partying at some place in D.C., and he started singing, and I started playing piano. We should cut an album and go on the road. We were good.
We were good.
Yeah. He's a great singer, and I was playing piano.
We got it bad, and that ain't good.
It was very cool. It's great to see you, Jim. All right, we have the winemaker from BV, and Rex is going to stick around, and we... shall return with the full-blown California Wine Country, winner recently of 2 Taste Awards, International Taste Awards, in Los Angeles for Best Radio Wine Program. And I'm sure we're going to get one this year or next year, too. All right, it is the internationally award-winning California Wine Country. My co-host Dan Berger, obviously back in with us. And it's great to have Rex Pickett. In the man who wrote the novel Sideways, was involved in the movie Sideways, and now, as a playwright, has written the stage adaptation, which is coming in September to Left Edge Theater at the Luther Burbank Center. Sideways, it'll be September 8th through October 1st at Left Edge Theater. So, it's great to meet you. I'm telling you, we got to talk a little more about... Pinot v. Merlot, but Dan, you have our friends from BV back with us. Introduce the winemaker.
Trevor Durling is the winemaker at BV, and BV has been around since roughly 1900,
yep,
so thereabouts. And it was the home of Andrei Chelyachev starting in the 1930s, and then it had several winemakers after that. But when Andrei left in the late... like 60s and probably, 70, I guess, would be
well,
the last minute.
I think, he was still kind of hanging around through 73 was really when he left for
right.
good.
Right. But the style of the wines had been formed. It's not easy to shift. It's almost as if you're turning an ocean liner in the middle of the ocean. The problem always had been... to use French oak versus American oak because it started out as an American oak aging process for the Cabernet. The fact that Beaulieu had never really attempted to make certain grape varieties that had become popular. For example, he'd never made Zinfandel.
Yep.
And I talked to Andre about that, and he laughed. He thought it was kind of a game for them. And he said, I would not know what to make Zinfandel out of.
Right.
But there's no Zinfandel in France.
So yeah, well, that's
right,
true.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
But anyway, this is a historic property and has done just a brilliant bit of work in terms of all the varieties that it makes, including Pinot Noir, which is – not your flagship wine, of course. The flagship is the bottle sitting next to me. It's the BV Private Reserve, which has been in the portfolio for, what, about 55 years
well,
or something?
1936
like
was the first vintage of
right.
George
wow.
Latour.
Wow. Yeah.
And my wine epiphany was the 67 George
yeah.
Latour.
Mine was the 68.
I wasn't even
and
old
mine,
enough to buy it. So
and mine is the 69. So there
you go. Sounds like we need to have a tasting of those three.
I got a bottle of the 69.
We need to have a vertical.
Yeah.
A mini vertical.
69 was an overlooked vintage, but that's it. We don't go there now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Trevor, you look like you're 22.
Well, thank you very much.
Yes, and you should
it's
say
all
thank
that,
you.
It's all that that moisturizer I use. It helps keep me young.
We need to talk after the show. How did you get into the world of wine and become a winemaker?
Yeah, so I was born and raised in right here in Santa Rosa, actually. So
wow.
I'm a Sonoma County boy. You know, had wine at the dinner table from a very, very young age and had early exposure to it. But quite honestly, it wasn't until I went to the University of California, Davis, where I enrolled in an intro to winemaking class early on in my college career that it really sparked an interest from an academic standpoint. And, you know, I took a course there my first year at Davis and came to realize how wonderful of a program they have there. And that following summer, I was hired on as a harvest intern where I was out in the vineyards pulling samples, you know, in the cellar with the guys, pitching yeast into tanks. And, you know, what really spoke to me, I would say, was the, you know, the agriculture, the art, the science, the combination of different things that I was getting to do. I'm not somebody that likes to sit there and do the same thing every day, so I love the variety. And it just spoke to me on many levels. And at the end of the day, it's a very social product. I'm getting to make something and enjoy it with friends and family.
And drink it. Yes.
And drink it and yeah. eat good food. I love to eat as well.
Yeah. So how many years?
So I'm going into my 16th vintage in the
wow.
industry. Yep. So I started when I was 5.
This is proof that drinking wine
keeps you young.
Keeps
yeah.
you young and makes you look good.
Thank you.
And I'm the opposite. But other than that, how long have you been at BV?
Yeah. So I actually just joined Beaulieu 4 months ago. So vintage 17
wow.
will be my first year with the winery. I've spent the last 8 years of my career basically right across the highway there in Rutherford at Provenance and Hewitt Vineyards. The good thing about that is I've actually been a part of the same overall winery network for many years as Beaulieu. So I've been very close to the program, have actually worked with many of the same vineyards. And one of my mentors in the industry was actually my predecessor at Beaulieu, Jeffrey Stambor. I've gotten to work with him and the winemaker directly before him, Joel Aiken, as well. So it's
Dan,
been in my DNA.
Dan, all your thoughts on BV.
Well, number one, Trevor worked also with Tom Rinaldi, one of my favorite people. Over at Provenance, and that had to be a great experience. He has such history and such a longevity in this industry.
He certainly does, and you know, Tom is he's who I would consider to be my mentor in the business. And,
great guy.
I will write a book about working with him over a period of 5 years one day because it was a fantastic ride.
Yeah, and then with Joel Aiken, you had somebody who really quite understood all of the dynamics that Andre had left on the property. I visited the property when Andre was about 6 months before he passed away, and we walked the property. And he talked about Joel Aiken in very positive ways and very warm and delightful reflections of his many years at Beaulieu. And then during that interview, Joel came along, and we were talking a bit about that question between going from French oak to American oak. And we've talked endlessly about Andre's impact on this industry, but Joel and Jeffrey both carried forward the traditions. That was really part of why Beaulieu has stayed right at the top of the game in the last several decades.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree.
And again, 1900?
Yes,
1900 the winery was established.
Yeah. It was when George de Latour himself founded
right.
the property.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Rex, talk about your experience with wine and how you came to write Sideways. I mean, were you heavily into wine? Or?
No, I was drinking wine just at the time with my now ex-wife, and we were drinking white wines because she thought red wines had too much sulfites in them, and we now find out white wines have too much sulfite, and it would give her a rash. But on the other hand, when she read Sideways, she told me to burn it. So, you know, then there's that issue, but we won't go there. But I started going to actually, after my second feature film failed and my mother had a massive stroke and my younger brother took all her money, I was kind of in a low place in my life, and then things got worse. So I started getting back into the game of golf.
And I would that'll go, cure it. Yeah, that'll cure it.
And playing in L.A. was, you know, it was expensive and crowded. So I started venturing up to a little-known place, the San Ynez Valley. And there was a great golf course up there, La Purisima, and I wrote a mystery novel called La Purisima. So thus Miles, the novel, he couldn't get published, and it got me an agent. And I discovered, oh, it's not just golf up here, it's wine country. So I'd stay overnight and at the Windmill Inn. By the way, it's just now been called, it's been rebranded the Sideways Inn.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah.
They still have the windmill there, I assume.
They have the windmill there, okay. But over the 101, and now it says Sideways Inn. And I was also concomitant with that. I was going to wine tastings at a little wine store called Epicurus in Santa Monica on Montana Avenue. It was kind of on the border between Rent Control, which is, of course, Rex, and the wealthy in Brentwood or whatever. And it was an interesting group of people talking about wine seriously and also looking down their noses at you if you couldn't afford. But for $4, I was able to sample a lot, and the employee there, I got to be good friends with him. I co-dedicate my novel to him, Julian. So when the owner left, you know, he kind of, you know, he took out his, I know, his ire about his salary on the inventory. Mm-hmm. So I got to, you know, learn more about wine as he got deeper and deeper. And but, you know, honestly, quickly, is wine, I mean, every year is different. So many countries, so many vinifiable grapes. And I love the, you know, being a writer, that it inspires poetry.
Yeah.
And that's something about Miles. It inspires the, you know, that in him. Do I like the snobbery aspect of it? No, I don't. But, you know, there's so much to talk about when it comes to wine. And so all these forces, to answer your question, Steve, to come all the way back around, all these forces, as a writer, you know, we're like thieves. We're always working. You're bringing everything to this moment. And one day I went up to the San Ynez Valley with a friend of mine named Roy Gittins. He's also co-dedicated this. And he's like Jack. Yeah. And we drive around, and we're wine tasting. He goes, Rex, you got to write a screenplay. And I wrote a screenplay. It didn't work. And then I wrote it as a novel in first person from the standpoint of Miles. That's a short version of it, but it really was a – people say, how long did it take you to write it? Well, 9 weeks, but really my whole life, but really the 10 years that I started going up the San Ynez Valley.
So the windmill in the movie is now – called Sideways?
Sideways Inn, yeah. And the Miles and Jack room that I stay in for $29.99 is now $359.
If Sandra Oh and Virginia
same
Madsen...
Same 100-thread count seats.
You better be getting a royalty on that.
If no, Sandra Oh and Virginia Madsen are still hanging around, I'm heading there this weekend.
I think they're over at the Santa Ynez bed and breakfast, but it's all right, Steve. You can look for them wherever.
By the way, the play Sideways by Rex Pickett... it will be opening September 8th, running through October 1st at Left Edge Theater at the LBC. Dan?
Well, I think what Sideways did for the United States culturally, even for people who had nothing to do with wine at all, had no interest in Pinot, was to bring to the public the fact that wine was a lot more mainstream than it had originally been thought of. There were a lot of people who thought of wine as a snob beverage.
Sure.
Beer was the everyday, you know, Joe Cool would drink beer and snobs would drink wine. Well, what Rex did was to really put a populist face on wine in a lot of ways. And that was really to the great benefit of the entire industry, whether or not people made Pinot Noir. It was a beverage that suddenly created its own persona. It had funny characters. It had wonderful scenes. It had great dialogue. It had a real personality of so many different people. And you brought a sense of mystery in a certain way to that film, because it really, in some ways, halfway through the film, you don't know where it's going. You have no clue where this movie is going to end up.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the beauty.
No, all the way to the end.
Yeah.
Like I said, I just watched it about, I don't know, a month and a half ago for probably the fifth time. And I was just as enamored and blown away as I was the first time when I saw it in the theater.
Thank you, Dan. I really appreciate it. I mean, I think White Zinfandel actually brought people away from cocktails into wine. So even though dreadful as it was and sickly sweet as it was, it actually was an introduction. Then, of course, we had the, you know, over-oaked Total Second Malolactic ML, you know, Chardonnays of Kendall Jackson.
Yeah.
But it got people more into wine.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the Merlot phenomenon, which we've talked about, you know, the vitamin E in the 90s. But I think Sideways said... people, you know, the hoi polloi, the fans of the film said, hey, there's something more going on in that bottle than I thought. I can't just show up at a party with anything.
Yeah, and before Sideways came out, probably there was a little bit, I would say, very few inexpensive Pinot Noirs were worth drinking.
Right.
Today, you can find $15, $16 bottles of Pinot Noir that are not only worth drinking, but are very quite reputable. And it's amazing that what the book did was to really change the way wine was being perceived. It's no longer that far out of range. Pinot Noir was not even considered in the talking points until that book came out.
Well, and thank you for that. Or when the movie came out, I mean, a wine list in 2002, 2003 might not even have Pinot Noir under reds. Also, the other thing, too, is what the movie did is said, hey, you can drink a lot and still get the girl. You know, so.
Yes, you can.
All right, Barry Herbst from Bottle Barn is here. I was hoping you would show up. This BV Shard. I love this. Dan, give me your thoughts, and then Trevor will explain.
Sure.
Well, it's actually a fairly elegant style. It's not overblown in any way. The oak is really in check. The way the wine is structured is that the mid palate is both rich and crisp. So you got both elements going on at the same time. Trevor, tell us a little bit about how the wine was made.
Definitely agree with your sensory comments, Dan. So this is a 2014 Carneros Chardonnay. It's made off of actually 100% from estate vineyards, two different vineyards, BV Ranch 8 and Ranch 9, located in the Carneros district. It's 100% barrel fermented, about 60% new oak or so, and about half of that is put through malolactic fermentation to add a little bit of the mouthfeel. Another thing we do with our Chardonnay is everything is aged Sir Lee. So we're going through...
Whoa. Geek alert.
Yeah. So let me explain what that means. So after the fermentation is finished, you have some yeast still in there and a little bit of solid content, and we go through and we stir the barrels, and that really helps to build mouthfeel and viscosity on the wine.
So you'll do secondary ML on just 60% and 40% no ML and blend.
Correct.
Wow,
correct.
That's great.
Yeah, and that'll vary year on year. It depends on what the natural acidity looks like.
I always wonder about this, Trevor. Sometimes they'll stop ML, too, by lowering the temperature.
Sure.
And that's another way of doing
That's another way of doing
but
it.
Or a more better way to control it?
Yeah, you can you can stop the secondary fermentation by sulfuring. You can turn the temperature down. You can filter it off if you need to. But it's really about that balance in the final wine.
This is a fine, lovely Chardonnay.
It is.
Let me say that.
Right up your alley.
It is right up my alley, and thanks to my buddy Jim. He's the singer in my band. I'm the piano player. We did it in D.C. Last year. That's a whole great story. I wish we could have recorded that. Mike, go get the keyboard out of Tanya's office. I'll play piano, and Jim will sing.
This is good to know, Steve. We actually have that in common. I took piano lessons for a little over 10 years myself.
Really?
So I should join the band.
All right. We could use two pianos.
There you go. Guitar as well.
I'm a drummer, but...
All right. Hey, we've got the whole thing.
But I taught myself piano when I was a kid.
Nice.
Oh, really?
Barry, what's going on at Bottle Barn, dude?
Bottle Barn, we just sent out the announcement for the Pinot Noir tasting.
I got it today, and we're going to be broadcasting California Wine Country live from the Hyatt that day.
August 30, and almost half the seats sold today. That's why I was late. It was a little around the
store. Nice. Explain what's going to be happening.
So it's a walk-around tasting between 40 and 50 Pinot Noirs, all mostly from California and mostly from this area, but we'll have Santa Barbara, Oregon represented. And $30 a person. There'll be some food there, and they'll be doing the show there. And 125 seats. I think we sold 60 today. So go to our website, Insider.
What day is that?
Wednesday, August 30th at the Hyatt Vineyard Creek.
I'm going to be back. Can you save me a seat?
Yeah, we'll send it. The guys at the store, if you're listening, go ahead and sign him up.
Rex Pickett, author of Sideways, wants to drink your penis.
Oh, this is going to be cool, and we're going to be doing the show live beginning at 5 there at the Hyatt.
Oh, yeah.
That's very cool. All right, I'm getting the break sign from Mike. Wait a minute. I'm also getting some...
Chardonnay.
Oh, Jim Morris says he has a recording of... Jim and I, you and I, sir, performing in Washington, D.C.
I need to hear that.
Jim, send it to Mike. right now.
It's good. Is it?
You are please do. Good. All right. The award-winning Taste Award, twice International Taste Awards in L.A., California Wine Country. My co-host, Dan Berger. Today, we're featuring our new BFF, Rex Pickett, who wrote the novel Sideways. It was involved in the movie Sideways and now has written as a playwright a comedy of friendship, romance, and Pinot Noir. It is a play that has played in various areas of the world and now is coming September 8th through October 1st with Left Edge Theater at the LBC. Rex, great to meet you, man. And
thanks for having me, Steve.
Again, you know, give me your thoughts, both you and Barry, Dan, about the movie itself.
I think the movie was just fun.
It was a great movie.
You could argue the point that on a surface level it's just pure entertainment. Uh-huh. But if you think about all of the implications and the impact it had on the industry and on society in general, it's really far more monumental, and it has a lot of messages down the road that really have carried with us. It, you know, this is a film that's, what, 12 years, 14 years? How long has it been
now? In 2004, 13 years old.
Yeah.
I think the characters feel very lived in, very three-dimensional. We don't really see those kind of characters today. Mm-hmm. I don't think Hollywood would greenlight the film today, honestly. Especially with the – no, not with those actors. They would greenlight a sequel if they – you know, are you listening to Alexander Payne?
And, you know, I kind of thought years ago that there probably would be a sequel because it was so popular.
No, it's, I don't control the film rights, but there could be a sequel to it. But anyway, we're talking about, everyone will, and I've written two sequel books. I can do that. I can do the play. The film's controlled, of course, by Fox Searchlight, and they would love a sequel, but Alexander Payne has demurred, although he might come around. You know, you never know about Hollywood. But I think the characters are they're so lived in, and if you can approach it as a comedy on just one level and enjoy it, that level, and then you can sink a little bit deeper, and it's about midlife crisis, and you can sink a little bit deeper, and
completely.
It's about failure. And,
you know, it's not a movie about wine, and some people think that it is.
It became that, yeah.
But no, it's a movie about two guys and their love life and their...
Well, I wrote it in first person from the standpoint of Miles Paul Giamatti. It was my life at that time, fictionalized, albeit, you know. But, yeah, I did, you know, sip from the spit bucket at one point. I put a lot of things in there. I didn't have a naked man run after me, though, but he does in the play. So, you know, there is a fiction. But there's a lot of, I like to say, use the fancy word verisimilitude, sort of ring of truth. And I wanted to get that same ring of truth with the wine. The wine is a component to the movie, and it is something that Miles is passionate about. He has nothing to really feel passionate about in his life because everything is really going wrong, you know, licking the wounds of a divorce and all this other stuff.
Stealing money from his mom.
Well,
excuse me.
I know.
That's
well, bear in mind, in the movie, the movie's a little bit different than the novel.
Yes,
you know, I mean, in the novel, not that this is justified stealing from your mom. She lives in Montecito, and she has a lot of money, and she kind of knows Miles does it anyway. But in the movie, she's living in Oxnard, and she looks, you know, like it's, you know.
And
he doesn't have a job in the novel or in the play, and he needs to pay his rent. Otherwise, he can't go on this bachelor trip. So I'm just differentiating.
Gotcha.
I'm not trying to rationalize. But, you know, he's a real lived-in, real – and I think people – he's relatable to a lot of people.
How does the play – and you were on with us much earlier, and you hit on some of this, but how does the play show the road trip?
Well, I mean, the play has 23 scene and setting changes. Here we've compressed a few of them, and it's a very, very – Des McAnuff, who did it at La Jolla Playhouse, said it was the most difficult non-musical he'd done in his 40-year career because you've got to keep – so that's one way we do it is when I was approached to do it at a little 50-seat theater, I said I'll only do it if we can – well, pour high-end wine every night for free, which we were able to do. But if we can make it
– from Sonoma.
And most of it came
right.
from Sonoma. It really is true, and Pinot Noir, and they loved it. But – We by having a lot of scenes, it feels more like a movie, you know, because movies are montage and they are scenes. Often a play, take the one most famous plays, Waiting for Godot. It's two people in a bush. Mm-hmm. Now I understand my next play will be two people and maybe you know a vine, you know. it's much easier to stage, but Argo Thompson, the director at Left Edge Theater,
he's amazing.
I was in a rehearsal last night. And he really is amazing, and they've found a way to do it and come out and see it. So that's how it feels like a movie to me. But it's also a real dialogue driven novel and a dialogue driven you know.
Yeah.
And that's what makes a play is dialogue.
Very cool, Barry Herbst, wine buyer at Bottle Barn. besides the big thing that we're doing, that you're doing, and we're going to be broadcasting the wine show live from at the Hyatt, what else is new at Bottle Barn?
Well, the rosé train keeps rolling down. I keep thinking we're going to have to take that display down soon. It's about the time of year we normally do it, and sales have never been stronger. So that's going to carry on until the harvest fair kicks in.
Everybody is loving the rosé these days.
It's amazing from everywhere.
And they're making great rosés, Dan.
They're making such great rosés that it's hard to know which one to buy. Spain, South Africa, God knows where. And it's just amazing, and it's everywhere in the world. With different grape varieties. And we're starting to see from Grenache, which is expected, all the way to things that you never imagined, Lemberger and stuff like that.
Blau Frankish.
Blau Frankish, that's another one.
It's crazy. Yeah, and, you know, there's all the category. Of course, all the local guys are still strong, but everywhere. You know, I was thinking about the effect of the movie on our business. I see it in two ways. One, it was a flashback to my childhood in L.A. I spent a lot of weekends up in wine country learning my trade in San Ynez Valley. But then also I see the effects in the business now. It really separated the wheat from the chaff and the Merlot producers. It the guys that have stayed in the game are the real deal now. So
well,
it's actually a great time to buy Merlot.
He wrote a great article about that in 2010, and we were talking about that earlier. Mm-hmm. But you remember how much it's changed wine tasting, the movie as well. We used to go up to the San Ynez Valley in the 90s. Mm-hmm. It was free.
Oh, yeah.
And that guy, Chris Burrows, who's at Sanford, you know, the guy with the hat, he was in the movie or whatever. It was just him and me for 2 hours.
Yeah.
And maybe some RV couple would waddle in.
Or be the winemaker pouring sometimes.
Sure.
Jim Clendenin or the guys at Zacha Mesa or all those. Yeah, they were just out in the tasting room all the
time. And it was like wine tasting 1 to 4, now it's 9 to 6.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's big business.
And then they started charging $5, but they'd give you a glass because they felt so guilty.
Right.
And now it's the $100 experience. That's what I had yesterday, you know.
Wow. Let's talk about some of the reds from BV that you guys are tasting. I can't do it.
Well, the BV 19, what is that? What vintage is that?
Well, this year is the
Rutherford.
2013.
2013 Rutherford. So you make, four separate, five or six different Cabernets, I guess.
Actually, a few more than that.
Who knows how many.
Yeah.
But the Rutherford is, so you do make a Napa Valley, and then you make a Rutherford, and then you make the Tapestry. Then you make the BV Private Reserve, the big hitter. To me, the standard bearer for the property has always been the Rutherford. It's I think it's a cut above the Napa Valley. I think it's clearly a more interesting wine in one respect. It shows what Andrei Chelyachev talked about as Rutherford dust. And it's not the actual dust from the soil as much as it is the faint herbal, the dried herb components that come from that district that you don't get in other districts in the Napa Valley.
I agree with that. And to me, it's also, you know, aside from the flavor profile, it's a textural thing. So I kind of describe, you know, Rutherford dust today, the way that I think about it, is kind of a chocolatey cocoa powder texture and flavor component that you get that's fairly distinctive of wines from the Rutherford Appellation.
And these wines will age forever. We've had really great examples of Rutherford Cabernets going 30 years, never
30.
Never expected them to, really.
Now, see, my nickname for Dan is Dan Lay It Down Burger, but I can't imagine.
You ought to write a song.
I will.
We really enjoy the old characteristics of the Rutherford because that shows the district even after many years.
Well, what my fans want to know is how much Merlot is in that blend.
Actually, this particular blend, there is zero Merlot. This is about 98% Cabernet, 2% Cabernet Franc.
Wow.
Yeah.
All the Merlot goes in Tapestry?
We use a lot of Merlot in Tapestry, so that's, you know, kind of a nice way to calm down the tannin structure that Cabernet
has. I mean, incredibly fruity for 98% Cabernet.
Yeah, so the majority of the fruit used in this blend is actually from our estate, Ranch 1 and Ranch 2, which is there on the Rutherford Bench, so on the western side of the valley.
Splendiferous wine.
Yeah. It's a great appellation.
The Tapestry.
What else you have over there, guys?
That's the second wine that you brought, the Tapestry.
Yep.
And that is a 2014, which is a bigger vintage than 13. It's got more guts to it, more power. But what I think is really exemplary of this wine, this is a wine that really carries with it a lot more of the more modern style, more, I would say, millennials will go for this wine, and I think the older generation would go for the Rutherford a little bit, whereas the Tapestry really has a lot of explosive fruit.
Yeah. Tapestry is a really fun wine to make from a winemaking perspective because it's not it's a red blend, right? So we're not necessarily held to having a specific varietal dominate the whole thing. Typically, it is Cabernet based, but we'll use a certain percentage of Merlot, Malbec, Petit Verdot, and Cab Franc in different proportions each year to just make the best red wine that we can out of what we're given.
And that's one of the best Tapestries I've tasted because it does hold together. It's got a lot of the nuances of some of the other varieties.
Yeah.
And is there a big difference in wood treatment between the Rutherford?
There is. There is. So the Rutherford Cabernet is around. I mean, they're both aged 100% in barrels. The Rutherford Cabernet is around 30% new oak, and the Tapestry is a bit bigger, so it's about 60% new oak on this guy. Yeah.
And Barry, BV has got to be a huge seller at Bottle Barn for years.
Yeah, we've got every single one of these wines, except I don't think Tapestry yet. That might is that just coming to the market? Maybe the
no. This has actually been around for a while. It's been made maybe since the '90s.
Well,
90s.
Keeping it, you guys will make the deals in the hallway right after the show. Tapestry. Yeah,
I know a guy.
Exactly.
Mike, traffic? Not yet. Okay, never mind.
And one last wine before we go, and we'll still when we come back, we have to talk about this wine. Mm-hmm. It's the monster. It's the big daddy of the show. It's called George de Latour Private Reserve, made since the 30s. What's fascinating about this wine is it's gone through several incarnations as a result of some economic factors that were influencing Beaulieu back in the 1940s and 50s, right after the war. And André really had to get his head around a whole bunch of different issues, one of which was the fact that the property didn't have any money.
Exactly.
Didn't have any. They ran out of dough.
Yep.
Explain that.
Yeah. So, I mean, there was a lot that went on then. And also in those days, they essentially moved towards – well, they did move towards the use of 100% American oak because you just couldn't get French oak in those days, partly because of the war. It was also less common. You couldn't really do that. And so that remained, kind of stylistically, that was a staple of the private reserve is that it was – American oak dominated up until really the 90s is when they started reintroducing French oak. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of a funny story, but André Telechef actually came back in 91, I believe, as a consultant. And the current winemaking team there talked to him and said, "Hey, André, you're going to love this. We haven't really changed anything. We're still doing things the way that you intended it back in the day." And he said, "Well, that's strange. I've changed and I've adapted. Why haven't you guys? So get some French barrels back in here." And so starting then, they began the use of French oak once again.
So no American oak now?
At this time, there really isn't. So is today, it's 100% 100% French oak. But, there was kind of a transitional period through the early to mid-90s where they were still using a bit of
it's
American,
got a very
even Hungarian.
Faint hint of mint in it. The minty component, is that from the vintage? This is 13.
Well, 13 was first off, it's one of the best vintages that I've seen in my entire career. I mean, it was really a winemaker's dream. You had a really low rainfall winter, and we had a vintage that just has tremendous concentration, but is also pretty approachable right out of the gate, right? So you can enjoy it now. You can also lay this down. I mean, this particular wine will age for 30 years, no
at
problem.
At least 30.
If you store it properly.
What's really fascinating is that as the time has gone by, these wines have actually been built better than they were probably 15 years ago, because 15 years ago, you're still sort of on the horns of a dilemma. You're just moving into French oak, still didn't know exactly where you were in terms of the style. Now the wine is really set. It's fabulous.
Absolutely. And, I think back to the minty character you were getting, we do source a little bit of fruit down in the Coombsville area and the cooler growing regions in the Napa Valley, and that's where you're going to get that character.
That's from the eastern edge of the southern Napa.
Correct. So a little bit more maritime influence. You're closer to the bay down there, so it doesn't get quite as warm during the day. But stylistically, something that we're doing now with oak that really we've only been doing for the past decade or so is we've incorporated barrel fermentation on the Cabernet. And that's very laborious. That's a process by which we're actually popping the heads off of the barrels, crushing about 400 pounds of must into the barrel, recoupering it, and rolling that barrel during
that
the fermentation process.
And that is a mess. It's a messy process.
It's one of those things that, quite honestly, I've done this for years on Provenance and Hewitt wines as well. And back when we were experimenting with it, I was somewhat hoping that it would be unsuccessful because it was such a pain in the butt to do. But we were so happy with how it it turned out, that we all kind of looked at each other after tasting the results and said, okay, we need to make this a bigger part of our program.
One of the reasons that this wine has beautiful texture, years ago, these wines would come out and they'd be a little tough in the mouth.
Yeah.
This one doesn't have that roughness. This has got more silkiness, but still plenty of age worthiness.
Yeah, and that's really, you know, that's the challenge, you know, as a winemaker, that's what I go for today, is I'm trying to create wines that can kind of cater to both ends of the spectrum. People that want to enjoy it now, and also those that want to age
like,
it for 3 years.
Like Dan, lay it down.
Exactly.
Burger, yeah.
Now that I know your nickname.
67 Jordan Latour that I had way back when had so much, it was almost like a handful of walnuts in my mouth.
Yeah.
You know, it really had that, so that you're able, and I thought that's what were the shoulders of Cabernet Sauvignon, but you're saying you can do it with less than that and still have ageability.
You can.
Yeah, you can.
And part of that, I mean, not to geek out too much on this barrel fermentation.
I love the geek stuff.
But, you know, some of what you get there is you're actually adding tannin to the wine by doing that, but you're also, you know, extracting some of those sugars from the oak
earlier on
in the winemaking process that kind of give you a rounder edge.
Yeah.
Trevor, you're pretty damn amazing, I have to say.
Thank you.
We've got Jim Morris, Drive Hall of Famer, one of our dear friends. Actually, I guess on his phone in April of 2016, recorded Jim Caudill and me, Jim singing at a bar in Washington, D.C., and then I hit the piano. Had no idea what he was singing, had no idea what I was doing, but we were both having fun. And Jim actually recorded it on his phone. Jim Morris. Jim, you ready to hear this?
No.
I'm
very ready.
I'm not either. You were a great vocalist. I was just noodling on the piano, but let's check a little bit out here.
The weekend's over.
How was that?
And gloomy Monday rolls around.
Yes.
I end up where I start. Kind of crying, my heart out. I said, Lord, up above me, please make her love me.
Yeah, well, they loved us, Jim. We got a standing ovation for some reason because they were as drunk as we were.
There you go.
Jim, you've got some pipes. I never knew, man.
No, he's a great singer.
You've heard of the Blues before. Those were the Browns.
I'll be shocked if you
win the Critic
Awards.
Yeah. That could have been the dagger.
Yeah. Getting no more taste awards in Los Angeles, I'm sure.
That's the end of this show.
Okay. He's going to be back with us before the run of his play in September. September 8th to October 1st, Rex Pickett. He wrote the novel Sideways. You saw the movie Sideways, and now it is a an actual play that they've been doing, and it's going to be at the Left Edge Theater at the LBC in September. Rex, great to meet you, man.
Thank you, Steve. Yeah, come on out. It's only 15 performances.
Then you'll be back.
I will
before that happens.
Yeah.
Next week, what do we got?
What do we have next
Tom
week?
Simino?
We have Tom Simino with the winemaker from Mondavi.
Oh, nice. Oh, and you'll be in.
Yeah.
Barry Herbst, you'll be back?
I'll be back.
All right. And we need to talk more about the big bottle barn thing that we're doing, that you're doing, and we're going to be broadcasting live from. Yep. Trevor, winemaker at BV, yep. Great to meet you, man.
Great to meet you. It's been a pleasure.
And Jim, always a pleasure. His author, Rex Pickett, author and playwright. He's the guy that wrote Sideways, the book. Then it was turned into the infamous movie Sideways. And now there's a stage adaptation coming to Left Edge Theater in Sonoma County here. Harry, how did you hook up with Rex? This is really cool.
Well, we've had folks from Left Edge Theater on before. They're really one of the most dynamic theater companies in Sonoma County. They're based out of the Luther Burbank Center up there in northern Santa Rosa. And he approached me a while back and said, hey, can we get in with our new season? We're going to be doing Sideways, and we've got the author of the novel working with us on it. It's like, absolutely. So a couple of emails later, and here we are with author Rex Pickett. Welcome, Rex.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
you
for having me.
Man.
Yeah, Steve.
You're going to stick around for California Wine Country, so we'll talk more about wine and the movie and the book and such. I want to talk more right now about the play.
Okay.
Did you do the screenplay? Not screenplay. The writing for this play?
Absolutely. The play is the adaptation is based on my novel, so it's a pure distillation of my novel.
Okay.
And actually, for legal and creative reasons, I can't use anything in the screenplay that's not in the novel. But I could if I really wanted to. No one would ever notice, you know. And Alexander Payne.
It's just sleepy old Sonoma County.
So, yes, I did the adaptation of my novel. I wouldn't let anyone else touch it.
So has it been performed before, or is this?
Oh, absolutely. I was approached in 2012 to do a little 50-seat theater. I thought, well, we're under the radar in Santa Monica. And I said, I'll do it under one condition. We pour high-end Pinot Noir every night for free. And they looked at me, wait a second, we have Heineken, we have Yellowtail Merlot here, whatever, in our little theater. And I was able to pull it off. And here's the interesting thing, Steve, is most of the wine, I used a woman up here in San Francisco, most of the wine came from Sonoma. It didn't come from the San Ynez Valley where the movie was set and shot. It mostly came from Sonoma. And we had people come. Gary Farrell flew down and poured one night and hugged me. He said, Rex, thank you so much. And
I go, yeah. Down in Santa Monica, it's all about Sonoma Pinot Noir.
And it broke all records. It ran 6 months, three performances a week.
That is cool.
Now, let's go back a little bit here and talk about the novel. You had a tough time getting this published originally, correct?
Oh, man. How long is your show here, Harry? No, it was very tough. I mean, it took a year before Alexander Payne even read it. And my agent who had submitted it to him, when I wrote the novel, it went to both publishing and to film. And publishing, we got 18 rejection letters. So my publishing agent, he said, well, we have to pull it. It's stinking up New York. Well, thank you. And we went to film. You don't hear about those rejections. And my agent who was going out to film companies with it, he had a nervous breakdown and left the business. Then I was really nowhere.
Wow.
But one of the submissions had been down the hall at then Endeavor. It's now William Morris Endeavor Agency. Had been down the hall to Alexander Payne's agent, David Lawner. And it took actually, Alexander Payne's assistant read it and loved it and said to Alexander, this is an unpublished novel. You have to read it. He read it, and suddenly my answering machine, I mean, I'm living on fumes. I've often joked that if I could have afforded a gun back then, I would have shot myself. But, you know, I literally –
I kind of felt that this morning when I woke up, but that's a whole other story.
But anyway, so a year later after it had been submitted to him, and when I thought all was lost with that book, because there was a lot of initial excitement with it, Alexander Payne read it, and he got off a plane, went straight to a payphone, called his agent, and then there was screaming on my answering machine.
And so then the book was easily published.
No. Alexander Payne optioned it, the book, and then Artisan Entertainment greenlit it in 2000, and it was front page trade news. In other words, Hollywood Reporter, Daily Variety. Payne goes sideways. Oh, my God. Here, my life's, you know, going to be restored to some level of, decency. And then what happened is they went back out to publishing, and they still turned it down. Then 2 months later, I got a call from Alexander. He goes, you know, Rex, I've got this other film with Jack Nicholson. It's called About Schmidt. I think I'm going to do that next. I thought somebody sucker punched me.
Wow.
I mean, you know, a $10 million green light, front page trade news. You still can't get your book published. And then the director says, I'm going to go make another film. So now you're going to wait 2.5 years. You don't know if the bloom is going to be off the rose when he comes back. He's on to other projects. And no one else wants it. Alexander Payne wanted to do it. So we waited. He got out of the deal with Artisan Entertainment. And it was even better because he then did it with Fox Searchlight, which was a better place to be.
But how did the book come about then?
Well, you know, the book, once Fox Searchlight then greenlit it, then the publisher. Actually, when we go back to Artisan Entertainment in 2000, the Japanese bought it. And I thought I was going to be the only novelist whose novel was published who couldn't read it. But they helped me out. But the Japanese bought it. So anyway, they waited, of course, until there was a film. And they were like thinking, well, wait a second. Maybe we made a mistake here. But no. So when Fox Searchlight came involved, now again, front page trade news. Now there's a cast announced and everything. And even only then did I get – I mean, the publishing industry, they pejorativized it as an oversexed screenplay. It's a very dialogue, character-driven. It's not. I don't spend 2 pages describing this guy. I get right into the F-bombs. You know.
Yeah. And well, you should.
Yeah, right.
Now, as far as the screenplay for the movie, were you involved in that at all? Or
absolutely.
Who wrote that?
Alexander Payne and his writing partner, Jim Taylor, wrote it.
Okay.
And they get all the credit, and they won the Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay. But they don't give it to the guy who wrote the source material. But they were nice enough, Harry, Steve, to give me every single draft of the script, which they don't have to do. When you sell it in a novel to film, I mean, look, in anyone else's hands, this could have been two guys doing Jell-O shots in Cabo. I mean,
you're right.
I mean, no, seriously. So, I mean, the fact that he shot it in the place where it was set and he used the real locations and everything else, I mean, that is a miracle. That is summiting the, you know, Mount Everest of adaptations.
Okay, so you get the novel published. Right. The film comes out. It's a big hit.
Yeah.
Merlot sales plummet. Pinot Noir sales explode.
Right.
How does it then make its way into play form?
Well, actually, I was approached to do the musical, but my agent turned down because they didn't want me to write the book or the lyrics, and there's no money in it, so we turned it down. And then I was doing a book signing at a hangar at the Santa Monica Airport, and a friend of mine, Marco Manone, who's a great writer, who's listening to this right now, he was, you know, assisting me in selling Vertical there, which is my sideways sequel. And a guy from across the street said, "Hey, what's this little known theater? I love your thing. Do you ever think about making a play?" And I said, "No, not really." And then I said, "Okay, but I'll listen to you." So he started to tell me about theater. He said two things. One, you get to hire the director. Well, no screenwriter's ever heard that. I'm telescoping forward, like, okay, let me hear more. And we can't change a word without – it'll be in the contract without your permission. Well, that's never happened to any screenwriter. You know, I mean, you have to be an idiot to think that's the case. So I said, okay, where do I sign? So – and, you know, so it was a little 50-seat theater. I thought it'd be under the radar. If it didn't work, whatever, we could just let it go. But it was so much fun. I mean, and I'd never done a play before, but I was at every performance, 87 performances. I didn't watch every one. I often said this, I got more love there every night than I did in my entire childhood.
Wow. You know, it always blows me away when a successful movie becomes a play, and I try to envision how that happens, what it looks like. Let's talk more about this play. By the way, it's Sideways, a comedy of friendship, romance, and Pinot Noir by Rex Pickett, opening September 8th and running through October 1st at the LBC with Left Edge Theater Company. So how do you adapt the book, and especially the movie, to this play? I mean, there's the two main characters,
yeah,
and I assume most of the...
Doing a lot of traveling through wine country.
Yeah. Well, I can't envision it.
I
know. You will. I mean, you'll see it.
Oh,
I mean,
one of
the things I said to the small group theater, Ruskin Group Theater, was I wanted to feel like a film, so we're going to have a lot of scenes. I later learned that maybe this wasn't such a great idea because when Des McAnuff got involved, the director of Jersey Boys, and we ultimately went straight to La Jolla Playhouse, it was really big, he read the play and he said, "How did you do it? You have 23 scene and setting changes, and you have the lead actor at the top and bottom of every scene." I said, "Well, come on up." So there, you know, it gets involved with all the different transitions. But I wanted it to move like a movie, which means a lot of scenes, as opposed to like a play, like, you know, Waiting for Godot, where you got two men in a
waiting
bush.
Waiting for Merlot.
Yeah.
Now, there you go.
Oh, yeah, all right, Harry. We'll just, you know, keep the day job. No, I'm kidding. Yeah. No, but seriously, that's smart. Two men in a bush. No, we have 23 scene and setting changes.
Wow.
One of the things at Left Edge, and Argo Thompson, the director, and Ron Saverio, who's going to play Miles, but he's very involved, they've done such a great job is saying, Rex, because it's a very difficult play to put on, actually, and we had some problems in London with that, although it still did very well. But La Jolla, they had all the bells and whistles. It was a $2 million production headed to Broadway. So it's a way to maintain the dialogue and everything else, but to figure out a way to finesse those transitions without having to use, we did at the initial theater, this little kind of commedia dell'arte thing that would come on and do little, you know, changes of the set. Couldn't do that at the Broadway level. We're not going to do it at this level. This will be the version that is going to now be able to be licensed to amateur theater. I'm really excited. The first rehearsal last night, I couldn't have been more happy with Argo. He clearly knows what he's doing.
The two ladies, I assume, are in it, obviously. They have to be.
The whole cast, I mean, they're all in there. I mean, you'd be surprised. You're reliving the movie in some ways. But, well, actually, I'm going to quote Des McAnuff. He said, "Rex, I love the movie, but when I read your play, I thought it was richer and more emotionally complex." Mm. It goes darker, but it is super hilarious. So bear in mind, Steve, the novel is very dialogue-driven. So what is a play? A play is dialogue-driven,
yeah,
in a way. So it really, the hard thing for me was I had to read my novel after 7 years. I had to face it, like, you know. But when I did, I had it was almost at the risk of immodesty. It was a cornucopia of riches for me, as for dialogue.
So the folks at Left Edge must be absolutely thrilled to have you available to work with them for a little bit.
Well, that's what they tell me. And I think they're happy I'm leaving now because, you know, I have a tendency to talk a little too much and too fast or whatever. No, I think to have, you know, look.
You know, I did notice that. We were hanging out in the green room.
Okay. Well,
but
you know.
You make for a great guest and a cool guy. So.
No, but, you know, the novel is written in first person from the standpoint of Miles, who's right. Paul Giamatti in the movie. It's very personal. I wore my heart on my sleeve. You know, my ex-wife, when she read it, because I was so excited, my agent loved it, she said, Rex, burn it. She's now, and she won an Academy Award. I'm behind two Academy Awards. She won an Academy Award for Best Live Action Short, and I wrote it. And she told me to burn it. And she's now chair of NYU Tisch School of the Art graduate film.
Holy crap.
Yeah. And I almost did. Well, you don't burn a file, but, you know, I mean, I guess you
delete.
You drag it into trash, you know, whatever. And my agent said, no, you don't want to burn this, Rex. This could be something. And then $500 million later and what it's done for wine. But it was – my point is not – you know, I love her. She's great. But and a woman I was dating at the time, she said, how can you be so personal? You know, they – I think it has that kind of personal – feeling to it. So I think for the actors up here, I hope, you know, if they're listening, is to have the real deal there in the room, the guy's voice. I spent all day with Ron wine tasting and stuff, and I think he had fun being around me, but they'll also maybe it'll be great for me to leave.
We're short on time. Okay. Rex is going to stick around, and in fact, stick around for this next segment. We're going to be talking about the Alexander Valley Film Society.
Great.
What the hell? Harry? You want to stick around?
Oh, perhaps. But let's just remind everybody that this production of Sideways will be running from September 8th through October 1st up at the Left Edge Theater at the Luther Burbank Center for the Arts. I'm sure.
It's a limited run in a small theater. These tickets are going to go fast. Trust me.
And we'll have these folks in as we get closer to the run.
Yeah, and I assume you're going to be up here.
I'm coming back a week before. I got to make sure they done justice to my words.
So get your butt in here on the show.
Absolutely,
Steve.
Thanks for having me.
And he's going to stick around for California Wine Country.
Absolutely.
And then we're going to talk more about Pinot versus Merlot and how this movie did what it did. And it's one of my favorite movies. I just watched it again 3 weeks ago.
I read a study that said it cost Merlot growers $400 million in sales.
Yeah. Well, Dan Berger's going to have a lot to say. And
they
so
earned
is Rex.
It.
But yeah, there's a whole story. And we've talked about it before on our Wine Wednesday show.
But wine appreciation grew just.
Absolutely. It was more than made up for by the Pinot Noir.
Exactly.
Growers.
In fact, I wasn't that into Pinot until I saw Sideways.
Well,
and then I said, oh, I got to try it.
Sonoma, literally, is the holy grail of Pinot, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to have you on with Dan Berger and BV today.